Hey, good morning, everybody. Let's turn some of these lights down. That one. How's that? Is that good? Hopefully that's good. Too dark? That's okay. All right, I'll turn the microphone down just a little bit. All right, so this is Bio 241. Okay, let's bring it together. I'll say a review a little bit from what we talked about last time. Move on to some new material. So today is February 10th. Let's look at the schedule so we're not caught short of time. All right, so today is the 10th, and we're going to actually continue with chapter 6. We're going to talk about chapter 6 today. We started that already, and chapter 6 next time. So that takes care of this week. Next week, we got a couple lectures on chapter 3, and then here's your first exam. So your first exam is 2 weeks from today. Right. And so chapters 1, 2, 3, and 6. Any questions? Questions? No? Okay.
Are you
going to
do any sort of a review at all before the exam?
Probably no review.
Okay.
We'll see. Enzymes and energy is kind of a short chapter. Cell structure and genetic control, a little bit longer. I can recap some things, but all those weekly modules in Blackboard are there for you to go back and review whatever we have programmed in there. Okay? Yeah.
Should we be on the second part of chapter 6, the pre-reading assignment?
I don't know, but I'd have to go back and read the pre-lecture reading assignments.
Maybe we should be on
the second part. I got two pre-lecture reading assignments for that one. Yeah. Yeah, sometimes the lecture doesn't correspond exactly, and I won't go back in and program when those answer keys open up, because it just, I've got three classes in here, just be too much. Okay, what else did I want to say? I haven't looked at the study guide. Oh, here is the sign-in sheet. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, please. If your name's not on there, please let me know. And of course, sign in down at the bottom if your name is not there. I haven't looked at a study guide in a little while, and I just want to make sure that on the study guide, it has the practice online questions, like in Blackboard. Before the page that you get to the quiz, there's a page that says practice these online questions. I really want to have those in your exam study guide for each of those chapters, and I'm not sure I do. I know I have the end of chapter questions I like, and the concept check questions, some exam figures, but I'm not sure I have those extra online questions in the study guide. So somebody show me a study guide and I'll look at that, and I want to mention that probably every time before lecture, and maybe send an email out to everybody. So it's good to practice those questions over and over and over again, not so that you memorize them, but so that you understand what's happening. And as a matter of fact, if you come up to me with a question from those online questions, guess what I got to do? I got to read the question, and I got to think about it, because a lot of those questions are not real easy. And so if I got to stop and think about it, I know you guys do too, right? So go back and look at those questions. That will build a really good foundation for you as we move through the class. All right, so that's the schedule. Anybody got a question on the schedule? We're good? We're pretty good? All right. Let's just go to this dual projection right here. All the lectures are online. I think I got them up pretty early last week. And I'll try and get this one up on Blackboard, on the website pretty soon. All right, so we were talking about some physical properties of matter, like diffusion. And diffusion means, I forgot. Who knows what diffusion means? It might be a couple things. Okay, so there's a molecule. Excuse me, I got to cough a second. So there's a molecule that moves from high concentration to low concentration. I like that. And in order for a molecule to move or to be able to move around, it's got to be in a liquid or a gas. We don't usually talk about the fusion of a molecule if it's in a solid, right, like your tabletop or in the concrete wall or something. So it's got to be one of those two kinds of systems, either a gas or liquid. All right, who knows something else about the fusion besides moving from high concentration to low? No ATP. And ATP you should think of as energy, right? And so diffusion occurs passively all by itself, does not require energy. So those are probably the most important things that you should know. But there's a couple other things I told you about in the equation. Sometimes things are directly related, other things are inversely related. Like, for instance, the size of the molecule is inversely related to the rate of diffusion. So as a molecule gets bigger, it slows down. Okay. The most important driving force is that concentration gradient that you just mentioned. So if we look at the slides here, and these little balls represent solute, right? And solute participates to make what kind of thing? A solution. So you have a solute and something else to make a solution. What's that something else? Yeah, the solvent. So here we have a solution on one side of the membrane, a solution on the other. And you see this is a nice phospholipid bilayer, but here's a nice protein embedded in it. So this sort of shows you the fluid mosaic model of how a membrane really works. And so here are the solute molecules. Don't care what they are. Where is solute at a high concentration? Extracellular fluid or cytoplasm? Yeah, it's high concentration extracellular fluid. So it's going to want to move by diffusion into the cell. But let's just say that this molecule right here is hydrophilic. Right? Will it be able to diffuse across the cell membrane? You know it can't, because this inner part of the membrane is hydrophobic. Right? This is a nonpolar region, so anything that is polar will not be able to diffuse through. And so we have these proteins in the membrane. Sometimes they're open all the time. Sometimes they're closed. Sometimes when they're closed, they can open up. So I see one that's closed, the same one that's opened up. We call that a gated channel, if it can open and close. And it will be gated depending on a number of things that we're going to be interested in this class for the rest of the semester. All right, so that's diffusion. Here you go. This is a good slide, right? Some things are directly related, like temperature, and, of course, the permeability of the membrane to that substance. And in this particular case, if all the channel proteins are closed, it is impermeable. But if this channel protein opens up, all right, this gated protein opens up, then the membrane becomes permeable to that solute. All right, then we started talking about osmosis. Osmosis is diffusion, but it's a special kind, a special case of diffusion. So we got to think of three important things, all right, that has to do with diffusion. And we got to this slide right here, and I see a container. And it's got a different amount of solute on one side compared to the other across this little membrane that we have right in the middle of this chamber. So can you see on the right-hand side, there's a higher concentration of solute compared to the left? Kind of subtle, but I think you can see that. And if we zoom into this region right here, indeed we see that there are more solute molecules on the right compared to the left. Within this little certain volume right here. And the small circles represent water. These small circles can move through this membrane freely because they're small enough to fit through these pores, but the large molecule cannot. So remember, diffusion, the rate of diffusion is directly related to the permeability of that solute, and the permeability of this solute and this membrane right here is zero. So the solute molecule cannot diffuse, because it can't get through the membrane, right? But water can. So water is a high concentration on the left, low on the right, so water is going to move down its concentration gradient through these little pores. Right? So if water moves from left to right and none of the solute can move from right to left, then the volume on the right-hand side has to get bigger because molecules are moving into it. Right? And is that active or passive? It's just passive, right? Because that's just a kind of diffusion. It's a little bit special because of this membrane right here. Okay, and so these particles, since they can't get through the membrane, we call these things osmotically active. Because if they can't get through the membrane, then guess what? The volume on the right-hand side of this membrane right here has to increase. It gets larger, right? Because water molecules are diffusing in. All right, so that is something that is really important to cells, because we would like to have our cells stay the same shape or at least stay in a normal range so that they don't burst or shrivel down too much. So these particles are osmotically active. If they could diffuse across the membrane along with water, then the volume of both of these chambers would stay the same even after a long time. All right, so these solute molecules you could think of as pulling water molecules into the right-hand chamber, and it's going to increase. All right, so this slide right here shows you pretty much everything about osmosis, okay? Because what molecule is moving?
Water.
So, and water makes up the solvent in this particular system. That's an important criteria for osmosis. It has to be the solvent molecule. And, of course, in us, the solvent molecule all the time is going to be water, and we see that right here. Another criteria for osmosis is that it has to be passive, high concentration to low, which is diffusion. Is it diffusion on this slide? Water is going from high to low, and indeed, okay, so that is diffusion of water, so that satisfies the second criteria. And the third criteria is that it has to move across a selectively permeable membrane, or semi-permeable membrane. And is this membrane right here selectively permeable or semi-permeable? And your answer is yes, because the large solute molecules can't get across. So this figure right here does satisfy all the criteria for being osmosis. And so it has to do with membranes. Okay. So this slide right here just says, again, if we have more solutes on the right compared to the left, water can get through the membrane, but these solute molecules can't. When water moves in, it's going to push this membrane over to the left. So that if we measure the volume at some time in the future, right, then the volume on the right is going to be bigger than the left. It's going to change, right? It's going to be 4/3, whatever the volume was at the beginning, and this is going to be less. It's going to be 2/3 what the volume was. And here you can even see some concentrations, right? So the chamber on the right had twice the concentration of glucose. And you can read it here, 180 on the left versus 360 on the right. And then this membrane is going to stop moving when the solute concentration and the water concentration is equal on both sides of the membrane, and we see that that is when both sides are at 270 grams per liter of glucose. And that's not really too hard to calculate because you can just do a volume ratio. You can just multiply this 360 by 3/4, right, and you get this volume here as opposed to on the left-hand side. You can just take this 180 liters and multiply it by 3/2, right? And so, 2/3, so it gets smaller. Okay, so you can just do a little volume ratio to calculate these concentrations, what it would be. All right, so there is a force that we call osmotic pressure. Osmotic pressure is the force that's necessary to push this membrane back over to where it was initially before diffusion started. All right, so there is a pressure that pushes it out. If we want to push it back, we call that osmotic pressure. And so osmotic pressure is just a measure of how strongly water wants to diffuse, right, from left to right. That is osmotic pressure. Okay. So if we have this chamber here with pure water, and we have a solution on the right-hand side, then for sure water is going to want to go from 100% concentration to whatever it is on the right-hand side. Okay, let's talk about mixing up some chemical compounds. Here we have a nice Erlenmeyer flask. At this mark right here, that mark is a nice calibrated flask. This is exactly 1 liter. That's the volume inside that flask. So if you fill this flask up with water to this level right here, that's exactly 1 liter of water. Okay. All right, so let's multiply, let's actually weigh out 180 grams of glucose. And I think 180 grams, we could calculate this with the periodic table, is 1 mole of glucose. And so if we put that 180 grams in the beaker first before we added water, that's 1 mole of glucose in here, and then added water so it goes exactly to the 1 liter mark, then we have what? One mole of substance per liter of solution. So we call that a molar solution. A molar solution is it's a measure of concentration by just the volume of this solution. Right? And those of you who've taken some chemistry, a mole is just a big number. It just tells us how many particles And a mole of silver, a mole of glucose, a mole of an amino acid will contain exactly the same number of particles, and you can see that that's a very big number. Okay, if we go to a molal solution, what's going to be different? Well, we still need to measure out exactly one mole of glucose, which is 180 grams, right? And then we're going to measure out 1 liter of water. And we can measure that with a scale, for instance, because 1 liter of water is exactly 1 kilogram. That's the definition, right? So if we put 1 kilogram of water in the beaker, and which is going to bring it right to this mark because 1 kilogram is 1 liter. But then if we add additional material to this beaker right here, then the volume is going to increase, right? So for this molal solution, the volume is greater compared to when we just made a molar solution. All right, so this molal solution is a measure of concentration by the weight of the solution, okay, or the solvent, sorry, the weight of the solvent. And in this class, we're going to be talking about molal concentration, not molar concentration, because that's going to take us to the next concept. All right, and the next concept has to do with osmolality. So here we have a nice system once again, and we have a membrane, and this is a selectively permeable membrane. And we see, can water move across this membrane? Yes, indeed it can. Right, and then we have some different solutes. On the left-hand side, we have glucose, and on the right, we have sodium chloride. Now, those solutes are a little bit different, right? Because when we put sodium chloride in solution, guess what happens to it? It completely dissociates into two particles, but glucose does not, right? So if we make this a one molar solution of glucose and a one molar solution of NaCl, or molal solution, one molar solution of NaCl, this is going to break down into two particles. So the number of particles on the right is twice compared to what it is on the left. Even though we started with the exact same number of particles, when we put salt in there, it broke down into two. All right, so now, what about the concentration of water? Here we have two particles, right? And over here we just have one. So the concentration of water has decreased on the right-hand side compared to the left. So water is going to diffuse into the right-hand side across the selectively permeable membrane, can, because neither glucose, nor sodium, or chloride can move through this membrane. So is this a selectively permeable membrane? Indeed it is, right? It allows water, but not these solutes. So this membrane is going to be pushed over to the left. Right, and if we wanted to measure the osmotic pressure, we would have to push this membrane, where? Right back in the middle again, and then measure the amount of force that was necessary to push that membrane over. Okay, so you can see that the number of particles that are in solution inside of the cell can have drastic consequences in terms of the volume of the cell, depending on the difference in concentration of water across that membrane. And a lot of particles in our cells are osmotically active. Right? If a particle is osmotically active, what does that mean? Osmotically active means, just a real simple picture in your mind, means that a particle is too big to cross the membrane, or it doesn't have the proper physical chemistry to move across the membrane. It just means it can't move across the membrane. So if water can, then it's going to change the shape of the cell. All right, so tonicity is a way that we think about how to control the shape of cells based on osmosis, which means then we're concerned about the concentration of water across the cell membrane. All right, so here are three ways that we talk about tonicity. All right, we have isotonic, hypertonic, and hypotonic. And let's see if I have a marker right here that works nicely. Oh, that works pretty good. Hopefully you guys in the back can see that. All right, so what's a nice little demonstration I'd like to work on? Okay, so tonicity, we're going to be thinking about living cells, the shape of living cells. So let's pick a cell that's really easy to think about. How about, I bet that's even the right color. It is. It's a red blood cell, okay? Really nice. So, it's green? Okay. Look, I thought I had nailed it that time. Oh, well. Okay, so here is, you're going to have to label it, I guess, right? Red blood cell. Okay, red blood cell. Let's just say that this red blood cell has a concentration of, let's just say, 97% water. Sure looks like red. 97% water. And, which means, what's the concentration in percent of solute? Okay, 3%. Oh man, I didn't do this before class. Do I have it backwards? No, I can't have it backwards. All right, so if we put this cell in a solution that is 97% water, okay, and 3% solute, whatever it is, right, and these are osmotically active particles, they can't get through the cell membrane, which way is water going to diffuse? Just generally, just give me the general concept. Which way is water going to diffuse? High concentration to low, all right. Where is water at a high concentration? Inside the cell or outside the cell? It is equal. So what happens to diffusion, the rate of diffusion when the concentration is equal? It stops, all right? So if water doesn't move in or out of the cell, what happens to the volume or shape of this cell? It stays exactly the same, all right? But when the cell is in a solution, it has to be the exact osmolality as inside the cell. Otherwise, something's going to happen to the shape of the cell. This is what we call isotonic solution. Let's do a couple more cases really quick. Here's that nice red blood cell once again. Let's just say the solute concentration is 0%. Then what's the water concentration in terms of a percent? It's 100%. Right? 100% water. And, inside the cell. Sorry. Inside the cell, it's going to be the same over here. All right, so 3% solute. And water is going to be 97% water, and this solution right here is going to be pure water, 100% H2O, like this. All right, so solute, remember, osmotically active, what does that mean? Can't move. But water, okay, can get through this particular cell membrane, and which way is it going to move? What's a higher concentration, 100 or 97? Yeah. Now, 100 is definitely a higher concentration of water than 97. Does that look like a big difference to you? It looks like a little difference, right? But that's enough of a difference that so much water is going to enter the cell, it's going to lyse the cell, it's going to blow it up. Water is going to get in that cell, the cell's going to get bigger, 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 and then finally explode. Just the small difference in concentration. Okay. The last condition. All right, so let's start with 3%, once again, solute, which means 97% water. Now, in this particular case, let's take a pretty salty solution. Let's take a solution that instead of 3% solute, maybe let's say it is 10% solute. So what's the percentage of water here? It's 90, right? So that's pretty easy. So 90% water, right? Solute is osmotically active, can't move across. Would the solute want to move across this membrane? Would the solute want to move across the membrane by diffusion? Yeah, because it's higher on the outside than the inside, so it will want to go inside the cell, but it can't because it's not permeable to the membrane. What about water? Water is permeable. Okay, and it goes from high to low. What's higher, 97 or 90? 97. Okay, water goes from high to low, so water is going to leave the cell. Okay, and in this particular case, it's not going to blow up. When it blows up, we call that lysis, and since it's blood, we call that hemolysis. And when it shrinks down like that, we call that crenation. All right, so anytime somebody is transfused with some kind of solution, then you have to be really careful that you give them the right concentration, right, of solution. So you got to be able to calculate that. So when somebody is transfused or is given some IV fluids, what should the solution be like? It should be isotonic because that preserves the shape of cells. All right, so this is isotonic, nothing changes. Right, this is the process that happens, but we want to know the name of this solution right here. In terms of that tonicity, we got what? Hypertonic and hypotonic. Okay? Right? Hypotonic. This is the hypotonic. So a hypotonic solution causes hemolysis, and here is a hypertonic solution, and it causes prenation. So that's a really important principle. And of course, in forensics, they use that a lot, very often, because they can tell exactly where somebody drowns, if it's in a bathtub or if it's in the ocean someplace. Right? So if somebody drowns in the ocean, what's going to happen to their cells? They're going to crenate. Okay? If somebody drowns in a bathtub, which basically has fresh water, 100% water right here, what's going to happen to the cells? Yeah, they're going to hemolyze. Right? So their red blood cells will definitely behave differently. All right, so how, I can tell you how I remember this without thinking. Do you want to know how to remember this? As long as I'm going to have you sign a release form that you'll never tell anybody else that I told you how to do this, okay?
Okay.
Okay, so here there's a nice E in hypertonic. There's that E right there. All right, and there's a nice O right here in hypotonic, and here is an O in hemolysis. Now, I can remember that. Maybe no one else can. Maybe it will help you, maybe not. Give that a try. All right, so that's what tonicity does. Right, it's going to change the shape of cells based on osmotically active particles. Okay, one of these processes is irreversible. What is an irreversible process? Hemolysis or crenation? Yeah, because once you blow a cell up, you can't get it back. If a cell crenates, right, if you have crenated cells, that is reversible. What would you do with that crenated cell to get it back to its original shape? You would, here are your two choices. You put it here, or you put it here? Where do you want to put it? To get it back to its normal shape, you would put it in an isotonic solution. Because if you put it in a hypotonic solution, yeah, it's going to lyse again. Okay? So, isotonic solution. So even if somebody's severely dehydrated, the kind of solution we give them is isotonic for that particular reason. Okay, oh, here's a nice illustration. I guess of what I drew on the board. You can see a couple cells, what the effect is. All right, so what about the cell on the bottom right? How would you describe this cell on the bottom right? That is? Yeah, it's in a hypertonic solution, but what has happened to this cell? It has crenated, right? Hypertonic causes crenation, hypotonic solution. I see the cell swelling right here. But it hasn't lysed just yet, but it will lyse very rapidly. Okay, so this is just very soon after we placed it in a hypotonic solution. Now, do these processes, right, either crenation or lysis, qualify as osmosis? And I hear yes, okay? Why is that? You got to convince me of three things. Why is that osmosis? Okay, semipermeable membrane, that's right. That solute we said can't move out, is osmotically active, okay? Okay, I almost heard you. I'll stop talking and then you can... I still didn't hear you. Ah, the solvent molecule is water, that's right. The molecule that's moving is water, which is the solvent. Okay, so that's two. What's the third criteria? Diffusion, but remember that's a loaded term. Diffusion means high concentration to low and no energy, right? So it means those two things. So yes, this does qualify as osmosis. Nope, because just when water moves inside the cell, that force is generated, and no other force is necessary for that to happen. That provides the energy for blowing that cell up. Okay. All right, so you can see that the regulation of osmolality, and that is just what, the number of solute particles in solution is very important, and it has to be controlled. And we use response loops to understand how it is controlled. And if you have response loops that maintains your body at about 300 milliosmol. Then what can you tell me about your body? Is homeostasis being maintained or not? Yes, right? So this is one property, like blood pressure, oxygen concentration, glucose concentration, that has to be maintained within a normal range to maintain health. And, yeah, what kind of feedback mechanism is typically used to maintain homeostasis? Negative feedback mechanism. So I think we should look forward to see a negative feedback mechanism right here. So response loop always starts with a stimulus. The stimulus is dehydration. Okay. What was the stimulus? I missed that stimulus. Okay. Is a stimulus. Dehydration is a stimulus. Okay. And when we dehydrate, our blood volume decreases. And that means that our plasma salt concentration increases, right? Our plasma gets more salty. There's more solutes for every solvent molecule. So that increases plasma osmolality. So these pretty much kind of go hand in hand. All right, so what happens when there's an increase in osmolality? Well, there are osmoreceptors, right, in the hypothalamus. It can tell how salty your blood is becoming because you want to be able to adjust it. All right, so if your blood is becoming more salty because we're losing water, the hypothalamus is going to give you a sense of thirst, right? And when you're thirsty, hopefully you have the ability to drink, right, to counteract that thirst. All right, so when you drink, what happens to blood volume? Yeah, when we absorb that fluid into our cardiovascular system, into our blood vessels very quickly, right? So drinking will increase water intake, and that will feed back negatively to what the initial state was losing water. Okay. All right, there's another mechanism. So it's not just behavior. So here is a behavioral way of adjusting your osmolality, but here is one that is controlled by a hormone in your body. But it still starts with the hypothalamus. Right? And can you remember from anatomy what endocrine gland is very close to the hypothalamus and is controlled by the hypothalamus? It is the pituitary gland, right? And the pituitary's got a couple of different regions, got an anterior, posterior part. Nonetheless, both parts are controlled by the hypothalamus. And in this particular case, we're interested in the posterior pituitary, right? And the hypothalamus then sends electrical signals all the way down to the posterior pituitary. When it gets down to the end of that neuron is going to release ADH. And so we see ADH, oh, it says right here, ADH secretion from the posterior pituitary increases, ADH goes to the kidneys, and ADH is going to tell the kidneys to resorb as much water as possible from filtrate. Now, you're going to have to rely on anatomy to understand what that filtrate is. If everything is left alone, where does filtrate end up? Filtrate ends up, right, filtrate goes to the convoluted tubules, the loop of Henle into a collecting duct. If it stays in the filtrate, it ends up in urine outside your body. Okay? But with ADH, water is resorbed from filtrate and put back into the blood, and in that case, you don't lose water in urine. Right? So that's the job of the kidney. So increase water retention. That's the job of the kidneys, drinking increased water intake. Right, which feeds back negatively to this initial stimulus, which is dehydration, and indeed we see a nice negative feedback mechanism. Okay, so I didn't talk about ADH yet. What does a diuretic do? Makes you pee. Yeah, it makes you generate urine. What does an antidiuretic do? It slows down or stops the production of urine, right? It's anti, and that's what ADH stands for. Antidiuretic hormone doesn't make you pee, right? It slows down the production of urine in your body to conserve water. Okay, so that's antidiuretic hormone. So if you're kind of confused with antidiuretic hormone, sometimes it's hard to think about a negative term. Think about the positive relationship. What does a diuretic do? And then just flip it in your mind to figure out what an antidiuretic does. All right, so an antidiuretic will increase blood volume because you will retain water, and that decreases the saltiness of your blood or the osmolality, and so here's a nice negative feedback mechanism. Okay, any questions on that? Okay, so hopefully you're really familiar with where ADH comes from. And this is the first time we talked about kidneys. Maybe you should go back and review what a nephron is made up of. Okay, so that you know where the filtrate is and what filtration and secretion and resorption are in the kidney. Okay, carrier-mediated transport. So we're going to talk about things that are going to move across the membrane, sometimes with energy, sometimes without energy. And right now we're talking about molecules that can't get across the membrane for whatever reason. Maybe they're too big, or maybe they don't have the right polarity. What's the polarity of a molecule that can move across the cell membrane? Nonpolar, right? Yeah, it's got to be oil type compound. Okay. So molecules too large or too polar to diffuse are transported across the membrane by protein carriers. Right? And in order to be transported, those molecules that are transported have to bind to that protein in the membrane before they can be transported. So there's got to be a binding of the molecule that's being transported and the transporter. How do we want to think about what's the relationship between something that binds to a protein? Why does something want to bind to a protein? Okay. And we're going to look at this over and over and over again, and that's because of structure. The structure of the molecule has to be such that it fits into the surface on the transporter molecule. Sometimes we talk about a lock and key kind of concept in our mind, or hand and glove concept, but it is by shape. Transported molecules have to have a shape that matches up with the transporter in order for it to work. So if the shape on the transporter is a square and the molecule that wants to get across is a circle, it can't get across because it can't bind, right? All right, so let's take a look at some special things about transport. Here we have a graph. The rate of transport of some molecule, let's just call it X, versus the concentration of that molecule on one side of the membrane, right? And remember, how is the concentration gradient? How does that relate to diffusion? Directly or inversely related? Directly related. Okay, so as the concentration of X increases on one side of the membrane, what do you think should be the rate of diffusion or the rate of transport? Yeah, it's directly related, right? So as we increase the concentration of X, the rate of transport increases. And we see that really nicely right here. All right, so... We just said that this X molecule has to bind to that transporter at some site, and the shape has to match up. And the shape has to be almost perfect, right? So we call that specificity. So maybe there's a glucose molecule that has just the right shape to bind to a protein in the cell membrane, then it can be transported. And it's very specific for that. So for instance, if an amino acid bumps into that transporter, Will that transporter transport an amino acid across the membrane? If the shape is built for a monosaccharide, in particular glucose. Yeah, it won't, right? Because it doesn't have the right shape. Okay, but if it's another monosaccharide, if that transporter is specifically designed for glucose, but another monosaccharide comes by, like galactose, which has almost the same shape, right, there is still some ability of galactose to bind to that receptor, and it will be transported across the membrane. Right, but what about fructose? Can anybody picture what fructose looks like? It's got a five-sided ring. Glucose is six, right? So fructose is, which is more like glucose, galactose or fructose in terms of a shape? Galactose. Can you picture that in your mind? I think you can picture, right, a five-sided ring versus that six-sided ring. So in this particular case, let's just say fructose can't get across the membrane because it has the wrong shape. Galactose can because it has almost the same shape as glucose. So when galactose binds, right, it will then compete with glucose for that site on the transporter. We call that competition. Okay? All right. One other thing. The membrane only has a certain amount of transporters. Even when it's working at 100% of its capacity, it can't increase the rate of movement of that molecule. And that's what we see right here. We see an increase in the rate of transport as the concentration of X increases, but look, it starts to level out. This is what we call saturation. No matter how high we increase the concentration of X, what can you tell me about that rate of transport? It stays the same. And that's because all those transporters are saturated, right? They're working as hard as they can. They can't work any harder. But if we put more transporters in the membrane all of a sudden, then what happens? Then the rate goes up once again until they become saturated, and then it levels off once again. So these are three important characteristics of carrier-mediated transport. Specificity, which means what? The shape has to match up almost perfectly, right? And competition means that similarly shaped molecules will compete for that site on the transporter. And let's look at that. So the solid line right here is when there is no competition taking place. There's only the molecule X in solution. Let's put another molecule in solution that looks a lot like X, has about the same shape. We're going to call that Y. So now we have both X and Y. That is shown by the dotted line. So if we increase the concentration of X, initially the rate increases, but what can you tell me about the saturation point right here? All right, saturation point, it comes earlier on because some of this Y is blocking the binding of X to that carrier protein. And notice that the rate even is lower, right? The slope of these two lines with a competitor and without a competitor is different as well, right? So the competitor will slow down the rate of transport, and the saturation level, right, will be lower. That saturation level is what we call the transport maximum. That's something else that we'd like to talk about. All right, so let's talk about a kidney really quick. In the kidney, through filtration, we lose water, we lose solutes, and glucose, for instance, it ends up in filtrate. And if that glucose is in filtrate, where does it end up? Okay, got to think of that nephron, glucose in the filtrate, where does it end up? Collecting duct, urinary bladder, outside your body, right? You'll be losing glucose. Glucose is a hugely important energy molecule. You don't want to lose a single molecule. So it is resorbed. It's taken from the filtrate, put back into the blood, and there is a transporter that does that. You only have a certain number of transporters in the cell membranes of those tubes, and once there's so much glucose in the filtrate, all those transporters are saturated, then not all the glucose can be transported from filtrate back to the blood. And then where do you find that glucose? Yeah, you find that glucose in urine, and we know that condition to be, what's that, when the glucose in your blood is so high that it ends up in your urine because of saturation of those transporters. That's diabetes, different kind. This is diabetes mellitus in part two, and there's different kinds of diabetes mellitus too, but diabetes mellitus. So way back when, how was it really easy to diagnose somebody with diabetes mellitus? Really, really easy. We do this in the very last lab in physiology. Super easy. Yeah, you just taste it. Taste a little drop, and if it's sweet, there you have a nice diagnosis for that. Yeah, taste just the taste of urine. Urine should not taste sweet, okay? If urine tastes sweet, then that's a nice sign for diabetes mellitus. If you were just a country doctor, the doctor would do it. If you're at a university, okay, if you're at a university, a professor would never do it, but a graduate student would do it. Okay. So it's good to get through school. Okay, that sounds pretty horrible, but urine, if you're a healthy person, urine is sterile. That's an extra credit. You know, I always wonder, this is true, I always wonder what a student won't do for extra credit, and I think we discovered something. Okay. All right, so these three things are important. We're going to see how these three things relate to enzyme activity and even how hormones work in the body. Right, just remember, specificity, shape has to be complementary, competition, and saturation. Okay. So here we have a nice membrane, nice phospholipid bilayer. Remember, this is a nonpolar region, so anything that is polar can't get through the membrane. Here I see a nice six-sided figure. What do you recall having a six-sided? Yeah. So here is a glucose, you know, galactose, something like this. So here's a sugar molecule. Where is it at high concentration? Right? It's outside the cell compared to inside. So will glucose want to enter the cell?
Yes.
Passively. Indeed, it does. Down its concentration gradient. But because glucose is polar, can it get through the membrane?
No.
It cannot, right? And that cell is going to starve to death when that happens, which is another thing that happens with diabetes mellitus, unfortunately. Okay, but here is a transporter. Here's a protein that goes all the way across the membrane, and it kind of acts as a teeter-totter. It changes shape, right? Sometimes it's open to the extracellular fluid and closed to the intracellular fluid, so it's not a pore or a channel, right? Because it's got to be closed one way or the other. And then it can change conformation, and now it's closed to the outside and opens to the inside, so it can just go back and forth, right? The way that it changes conformation is that glucose will diffuse into this area, just go down its concentration gradient, and it just so happens that there's a spot on this protein that matches up the shape with glucose. Glucose will bind to this part of the protein, and when it binds, that's going to change the conformation of this protein, right? And so it opens up now to the inside of the cell, and it's released from the transporter, and now this glucose can diffuse inside the cell. All right, so change in conformation of this protein does not require energy, right? You should think of the difference of concentration right here as the energy that's necessary to get this protein to change conformation. So just write down in your notes, a concentration gradient is a form of energy. Concentration gradient is a form of energy because if we just let things alone, that concentration gradient will disappear. Oh, I wanted to say something really important. Okay, now it doesn't take a lot of energy to get this transporter to change conformation. We could do a little experiment right here. Sometimes these proteins are very sensitive, right? So if you take your finger, right, and just poke yourself in the shoulder like that, is your body going to move very much? It's not. Okay, take that same finger and poke your friend that's sitting next to you in the side, same force. What's going to happen? Large change in conformation, right? Okay, depending on circumstances, could be a huge conformation. You can end up with a black eye, all right? So this binding right here, these proteins can be very sensitive to binding of this molecule. But what about this molecule? It has to have the right shape. And what do we call that in one word? That's called specificity. Yeah, specificity, okay? Okay. Here is something really cool about a lot of carriers, including one for glucose. So here we have the cell membrane, and I just see a phospholipid bilayer. I don't see any transporter molecules in there. And so let's just say there's high glucose on the outside. Will glucose want to get to the inside?
Yes.
Yeah, but can it?
No.
There's no way. Can't get through the cell membrane. But look at these guys right here. Here's a vesicle, and a vesicle is a membrane-bound system, and it looks just like this phospholipid bilayer. In this vesicle are all of these transporters for glucose. Well, wouldn't it be cool if there was a way when the cell wanted glucose to put all these transporters in the membrane all of a sudden? And here is a way to do that, right? It just hops a ride on a microtubule. This vesicle gets pushed over to the cell membrane, and the membranes basically have the same structure. They fuse together. Now, these protons are embedded in the cell membrane, and they can go to work allowing glucose to move from high concentration to low. All right, so high concentration to low, what kind of motion is that once again? High to low? Diffusion. But in this particular case, it needs the help of this transporter, so we call that facilitated diffusion. Facilitated diffusion seems really complicated, and it sort of is a little bit more complicated, but it is still diffusion. I don't see any energy molecule being used up with the process over here, right, on the left-hand side. Of course, it does take energy to move this vesicle around, does take energy to build all of these proteins, but not just think of the simple process of changing conformation of this protein. All right, so we call this vesicle an endosome. It can store membrane proteins until that function of whatever those membrane proteins do for the cell until it's needed, right? Because it takes a long time to build a protein, and it takes a lot of energy. Well, here is a way to make all of those proteins in advance, so if you need it in a hurry, what can happen? All you got to do is fuse that endosome to the cell membrane, and you are ready to go. So it's nice to have a reservoir of all these things that can be activated in just a moment's notice. All right, so that is an end zone. Let's look at another kind of transport. How about active transport? Which way can things move with active transport? Okay, from low concentration to high concentration, right? And it's going to require energy. The most common form of energy in our body is ATP. Question?
Can we go back to the previous slide?
Let's see. Yes, we can. Okay.
So what role does insulin play in this process?
Yeah, insulin binds to a receptor on the cell membrane.
Okay.
That's not shown on this slide. When it binds to that cell membrane, it activates a number of mechanisms inside the cell. We'll look at a couple of them. We're still discovering some of these. Right, that mechanism then causes this vesicle to move over to the cell membrane, and then these glucose transporters are in the membrane. And when glucose moves from the blood into the cell, because these things are in the cell membrane, what happens to glucose concentration in the blood? It goes down. And so that's why I say insulin is like a passport that allows glucose to enter a cell, because insulin places these transporters in the cell membrane in most of the cells in our body.
Okay.
There's one exception to that. There's another thing that can put these transporters into the cell membrane to decrease blood glucose. And I'm kind of afraid to tell you, because you'll hate me, you'll hate this class if I tell you. Should I tell you anyway? It's kind of half and half, okay. I guess I got to tell you. When you exercise a muscle that's just like an insulin signal, it puts these glucose transporters in the cells of those muscles, and then blood glucose concentration decreases, right? So it counters that diabetes mellitus effect. But what do you have to do? Yeah, well, I'm glad nobody threw anything at me. Okay, so exercise. Right, if somebody doesn't have a severe case, exercise always helps somebody with diabetes. Okay. Yeah.
But we understand, we already have the, you know, like for the diffusion, we already have the, you know, like the open channel.
Where? I don't see an open channel.
Here.
That's closed.
Oh.
And it's closed here.
But why do we need this? We just need one channel, but why do we still need this?
Ah, well, this channel right here can only take one glucose at a time, and it might take all day. And in the meantime, this cell is starving for glucose. So let's put, as glucose concentration increases, let's put more transporters in so the cell can take up the glucose that's there in the blood. Okay?
We need this one to store the glucose.
Yeah, we're going to store all these proteins until we need it. When do we need these transporters, right, in the cell membrane? And you got two possible answers. When you're in a fasted state or when you're in a fed state? When you're in a fed state, because then you're absorbing glucose from your food. It's going into your blood. Your blood glucose goes up when you're in a fed state. Blood glucose has a tendency to go down when you're in a fasted state. So we're going to look at some really nice mechanisms. Maybe you already did. Yeah, we talked about insulin and glucagon already. A nice antagonistic hormone pair. Right, to control blood glucose? Okay. All right, so we've got to change topic. Active transport. Here we got a nice cell membrane. Here we have, what is this? Ca2+. I thought this was a physiology class, not a math class. What's this two plus thing? Oh, yeah, I forgot. That's an ion. Okay, and 2+ just means that it has two positive charges on there, and Ca stands for calcium. So this is a calcium ion, right? And what kind of ion is that? That is a monovalent? No, it's not. Bivalent, divalent. We're almost there. Divalent. Divalent, bivalent. Cation. Cations are positive. What's a negative ion? Anion. Yeah, don't forget that terminology. I think we went over that already. Okay. So here is a divalent cation, not really too important for this discussion, but it is an ion, so it dissolves in water. And calcium, okay, here's the extracellular fluid, here's intracellular fluid. Calcium in most cells is almost zero in the cytosol. All right, so here it is very low concentration of calcium, and on the extracellular side, it is very high calcium concentration. All right, so will calcium move by diffusion from inside to outside the cell?
No.
if it is low to high. It cannot, right? But it is so important to have low concentration of calcium inside the cell that the cell has to get rid of it, at least within the cytosol. So here is one of those, another one of those proteins. In one case, it's open to calcium on one side of the membrane, but it is closed on the other, okay? All right, calcium can diffuse into this membrane protein, and it will bind, but that's not enough energy to cause a conformation change in this protein. There's something else that is necessary. What allows this protein to change conformation is that there's another site over here that can bind an ATP molecule based on the shape of ATP. And what is ATP carrying around for us? Energy. Yeah, and we talk a lot about energy in a second. I'll tell you, try to figure out what energy means, okay? All right, so ATP carries energy for us. When ATP is broken down to ADP and inorganic phosphate, remember how many phosphate groups are in ATP? There are three. All right, and if we take one of those phosphate groups off, we get this inorganic phosphate right here. It's just not a P. It has some hydrogens and oxygens on it as well. That means there's one left, or one less on ATP, so we call that adenosine diphosphate. So there's a nice covalent bond in ATP right here, and that covalent bond is strong, which means that it contains a lot of energy. When that bond is broken, it releases that energy. It can be used for a number of things, including this transporter that we're looking at here. Right, when ATP is bound, but there's got to be a calcium in there as well, it changes conformation. Now, calcium can just diffuse out right into the extracellular fluid. Hence, it's going to go from low concentration to high, but it requires one thing to do that. It needs that transporter for sure, but that's not what I'm keen on. I want you to find something else on this illustration that's always going to tell you that it's active transport, and that is ATP. If you see ATP on an illustration, you're going to see that to be an active transport, and even as a matter of fact, maybe in your notes, put down primary active transport, one with a degree sign, or you can write down primary active transport. So again, you see this ATP, what do you know is happening there? Boom, primary active transport, not diffusion. All right, so if something is moving from low concentration to high concentration and ATP is being used up, right, because that's an active process, sometimes we call these things pumps, right? It's a calcium pump. And what does a calcium pump need to work? It needs ATP because it's primary active transport. All pumps, when we talk about a pump, require ATP. And as a matter of fact, most of the energy that we utilize every day, right, is just to keep these pumps working in our cell membranes all over our body. Not just for calcium, but for sodium and potassium and other kind of ions as well. Okay? I forget what the percentage is. Somebody should Google that, let me know, because I forgot. Okay. I could couple that with a urine tasting experiment and see. Okay? Probably not. Okay, so ATP, very important, right, for working all these pumps in our body, for muscle contraction. And I have never told this class, I don't believe, how important ATP is in your body. Right? You make ATP by bringing in oxygen. Mitochondria then take your glucose and other energy molecules and make ATP out of it. But they have to have oxygen, right? So if we cut off the oxygen supply to those mitochondria, they can't make ATP anymore. So then you start to run out of ATP. So let's think of our brain. Let's cut off the oxygen to somebody's brain, like we stop their heart. Blood can't get to the brain. How long can they maintain consciousness, right, before they run out of ATP? ATP allows you to maintain consciousness because of all these pumps that are working. If blood is cut off your brain, how much time do you have before you're unconscious? Okay, I heard a couple minutes, I heard some other people have an opinion, right? It's 2 to 3 seconds, that's it. Okay, 2 to 3 seconds, somebody goes into ventricular fibrillation, 2 to 3 seconds of consciousness, and then you just fall on the floor. But the brain is not dead, right? It still can be revived. But if the brain can't make ATP, eventually it is going to die. So how long does it take for a person's brain to die after it cannot make ATP? Like, for instance, when blood supply is cut off. 2 to 3 seconds, you lose consciousness. 2 to 3 minutes, then the brain dies. And remember, when something dies, you can't bring it back, right? It's irreversible process. So that's why that CPR is such an important technique. Okay? CPR, one of the things you do with CPR is that you do chest compressions, and what is that helping that person? Yeah, it's like helping somebody's heartbeat. It doesn't pump a lot of blood. It pumps a little bit of blood to the brain. It might be enough to keep that brain alive, maybe not enough ATP so that they jump up and say thank you, but it might be enough to where that brain is still alive by the time they get to the emergency room. Yeah, so don't ever stop chest compressions. Keep them going until the EMTs get to that person and take them to the hospital. Especially if it's me. Don't ever stop. You know, people say, oh, you can stop after a couple minutes or this or that, but I'm sorry. If that happens to me, you just have to do it forever. That's the way it goes. Yeah. We had a question.
Yeah. What did you say when oxygen is cut off the brain?
Oh, when oxygen, our blood carries oxygen to all the places in our body, right? When blood stops delivering that oxygen, in particular to mitochondria, then the mitochondria stop making ATP. Okay? And when those mitochondria stop making ATP, the ATP that we have gets used up. It gets used up so fast that you have 2 to 3 seconds of consciousness in your brain. So that gives you kind of a feel of how important ATP is in our body. Another way that I think about how important ATP is, okay, is like if we were to measure how much ATP we needed in a day, okay, let's measure out. And we don't need this amount because our body makes it. But if we just had a suitcase or, you know, envelope of ATP, how much would we have to have? A typical weight of a person is 70 kilograms. Nobody in here is probably 70 kilograms, but there's some above, some below, right? That's kind of like the average weight, okay? So the average amount of ATP in terms of a weight of a person is 40 kilograms. What is that compared to the weight of your body? It's more than half, right? So that's how much ATP, and so we got to look and see where all that ATP comes from. And we do that in the respiration chapter. That's coming pretty soon. Right? That's some biochemistry after we get through this chemistry right here. All right, when I look at this slide, what can I see? Which is really fast, casual inspection. What's happening on this slide? And I'll give you a hint. I see ATP. Active transport. And primary active transport. Okay? All right, so that means I see something moving from low concentration to high, and then I could figure all that out, but oh man, you're going to see that ATP right away. Here is another pump. All right, and a pump is passive transport or active transport?
Active.
Active transport. When you look at this slide, I'm going to take it away once again. Do you want to look at that slide once again? Okay, look. Okay, I took the slide away. What is happening there? Active transport. Let's look at it one more time. Okay. Oh, I took it away. Did you see an ATP molecule?
Yeah.
So what does that mean? Primary active transport. Okay. So I saw that right away. Primary active transport. This is, all right, everybody's favorite transporter. This is a sodium potassium, and we say ATP pump because here's an ATP that's being hydrolyzed. You know, that kind of reaction requires a water molecule, right? Okay. Here's a sodium potassium pump, and we see that is pumping potassium from low concentration to high against diffusion, and it's taking sodium from low concentration to high concentration again. That's against diffusion. That can't happen automatically. That's going to require energy, and in this particular case, it's ATP, so primary active transport. So when you look at this slide right here, okay, where do we typically find the high concentration of sodium ions? Inside your cell or outside? That's going to be critical in this class. Yeah, sodium is high on the outside. What about potassium? Where is it high? It's going to be high inside the cell, and that happens because it requires energy to do that, right? And it happens because of the sodium-potassium pump. And remember, that's primary active transport. So there's got to be binding sites for sodium, a different binding site for potassium, and even another binding site for ATP. They all have to fit into this protein in the membrane in order for it to work. All right, so don't forget, what can you tell me about potassium? Kind of similar to sodium.
It's
I think you told me, but I was talking. Yeah, it's a monovalent cation, right? They're both cations. They both have an electrical charge, right? They both have an electrical charge. So when these electrical charges are moving around, that's an electrical current when that happens, right? So that's pretty interesting. All these cells have all these electrical currents running around in them. All right, but here is something that's strange. This sodium-potassium AT pump will pump 3 sodiums out for every 2 potassium that go in. All right, and so for sure you got higher sodium on the outside, higher potassium on the inside, but in terms of these electrical properties, what is happening? What about positive charge? Where's positive charge accumulating? 3 sodiums out for every 2 potassiums going in. So positive charges accumulate on the outside of the cell, which is another way of saying that the inside of the cell becomes more negative, right? It's exactly the same thing, all right? So inside the cell, if we just look at the electrical properties as negative compared to the outside, and in your pocket you have at least one device that is doing that, right? And it is powering your cell phone or your calculator. Okay, you got one in your car. Yeah, battery, right? So a battery is set up so that there's a gradient of electrical charge from one terminal to the other terminal. Battery usually has 2 terminals, right? And so every cell in your, every cell membrane in your body or every cell in your body is acting like what?
A battery,
right? All right, so that energy in ATP was used to make this concentration gradient and a gradient of electrical charge. And so that is a storage form of energy that can be used by other kinds of processes we'll see later on in the class. All right, so because sodium moves out 3 at a time, potassium moves in 2 at a time, we say that this pump is also electrogenic, right? It develops an electrical charge across the membrane. An electrical charge is just a fancy way of saying that across the membrane has more positive charges than on the other side, or negative charges on one side compared to negative charges on the other. So we call that a voltage. We can also call that a potential. Right. So we call that a potential for the following reason. And you know this already. Say we have a particle with a positive charge and a particle with a negative charge. Will they repel each other or attract each other? Yeah, they will attract each other. So that attraction is what? Some kind of potential motion, potential union of those two particles, right? That is a, when they're separated, that's a high energy state. Okay, and that energy in this case comes from ATP. Here is another kind of active transport. Okay, and I see it happening right here. I see it happening right here. And I'm going to take it away. Kind of a nasty trick. Okay? All right, and I'll let you see it once again. Okay, do you see ATP? No, I don't see ATP. So this cannot be primary active transport. We're going to see that it is active transport, but not of the primary variety. All right, so let's see if I can describe this illustration right here. All right, so here we have sodium. All right, and sodium is being transported all the time. Which way? Inside or outside your cells? Yeah, it's going outside. Will it want to go inside the cell if we just leave it alone? It will want to diffuse inside the cell because it's high outside, low inside, so just by the concentration gradient, right? It will also want to go inside the cell because it's negative inside the cell. What's the charge of sodium? Positive. So those charges would like to cancel each other out. So sodium is just dying to get inside the cell, but it can't because of that sodium-potassium ATP pump. So if you want to draw in something right here, you could draw in ATP, right? Because here we say this is primary active transport, requires ATP. Get a nice yellow marker or whatever, how you color ATP, or that, that ATP molecule. So because this is primary active transport, which way can sodium go? From high concentration to low or low to high? Low to high. So let's look at this hill right here. It kind of reminds me of my little MGB car, right? So this sodium potassium ATP pump pumps a lot of sodium outside of the cell, right? And remember that sodium wants to rush inside the cell. If we let it rush in and couple it to a special mechanism, like on this teeter-totter right here, right? So the energy of sodium rushing inside the cell will cause this teeter-totter to switch and it can actually move this glucose molecule from a low concentration to high concentration. All right, so if we were to draw a nice graph, right, the vertical axis would be concentration. Right? And so down over here would be low concentration, up over here is high concentration. What do we call the motion of low concentration to high concentration? That's active transport. But do you see ATP here?
No.
So can it be primary active transport? It cannot, so we call this secondary active transport. So secondary active transport uses a concentration gradient of some other compound. Sodium is one of our favorites. When sodium enters the cell, and you told me it loves to enter the cell, if there is a way to do it, if there's a protein, and this protein has a special little mechanism, another site for glucose, it can make glucose go from low concentration to from low concentration to high concentration. All right, so glucose can enter a cell when sodium enters the cell as well. This is secondary active transport. There are a couple different kinds of secondary active transport.
So, question.
Yeah.
So from the glucose, the glucose here, they have the low concentration. And
okay. Yeah.
Just ATP, so how can they move it?
Okay. So let's just say here's glucose infiltrate in your kidney. And if it stays there, you're going to lose it from your body. Healthy people, that doesn't happen. All right. So how do we get that glucose going from low concentration to high? Here is one mechanism. All right. So glucose enters cells and in your body. And here we have sodium. What does sodium have to do? It has to enter the cell as well. So sodium entering the cell causes glucose to enter the cell, but their motion is different from high concentration to low, right? That's why it looks opposite here, but both sodium and glucose are moving in the same direction. They're both moving inside the cell, and that energy, that extra energy, comes from the gradient of the sodium concentration, because sodium just loves to rush inside the cell. It's got extra energy, and it will support this process of moving glucose from low concentration to high concentration. Yeah, it is coupling. So this is a way of coupling, and it's usually due to just one special protein in the membrane that allows that to happen.
So this just specialized for the.
Oh, a lot of things work this way. We're going to look at some specific mechanism. Here's just one specific thing, glucose. Okay. But what sets this up is primary active transport, right? So secondary active transport can't happen unless primary active transport is working to make the system work. Okay? Okay. Well, we just saw in that previous example, I didn't do a really good job, but we just saw that sodium and glucose are moving in the same direction. Sodium is moving inside the cell, glucose is moving inside the cell. So we want to talk about these processes a little bit differently compared to if the molecules are moving in different directions. Here we have a nice cell membrane. Here is a transporter for glucose. It's going to help resorption of glucose from filtrate, put that back into your body. And here's a sodium, right, that is high outside the cell because of all those pumps that are working all the time. They're pumping sodium out. Sodium is high concentration in the extracellular fluid. It can bind to this protein. Notice this protein is not a channel. It's always going to be closed at one end, either outside the cell or inside the cell. Can't be open at both times. In this particular case, it's open to the outside, so sodium will diffuse in, glucose will diffuse in, and when they bind to this protein, right, it's like poking your neighbor in the side. That's enough energy to change a conformation of this protein, so now it's closed to the outside world, and the intracellular side is now opens up. So sodium goes down its concentration gradient, but glucose goes up its concentration gradient. And there's more energy involved with sodium entering than glucose entering. Otherwise, it wouldn't work. Right, so again, that concentration of sodium, the concentration difference of across the membrane is the energy source where this glucose molecule enters the cell. All right, so sodium moves down its concentration gradient while glucose moves up its concentration gradient. If molecules move, two molecules move in the same direction, we call that co-transport or symport. I like symport. You could say co-transport. I don't know what's in your book or on the online quizzes. Right? Co-transport. I'll understand what you're saying. It is secondary active transport. So two molecules are moving in the same direction. Co-transport. Now, why do we know this is secondary active transport? No ATP directly used, right? Counter-transport is when, for instance, sodium might move in one direction and glucose moves in the other. That can happen. All depends on this protein right here. That's what we call counter-transport, or I like antiport, right? An antiporter moves molecules, right, in opposite directions. And again, it's secondary active transport because it uses the concentration gradient of one of those materials, right, as an energy source and not ATP directly. So if something is moving from low concentration to high concentration and you don't see ATP, what kind of transport is that? And it's active transport. Low to high is always active transport. Okay, so just kind of look at these definitions right here. Here is a real-world scenario. This is an important exam figure. We go to, what, 1245 today? 1250? 1245? Okay. All right, so here I see a bunch of cells all lined up together, and they're packed closely together. What kind of tissue that has the cells all packed closely together? An epithelium, exactly right. So here's an epithelium, right? And so this lines a tube in your body, and let's just say that this could be the lumen of a kidney tubule. What does that mean? Anybody remember what lumen means? Yeah, it's the center of a tube, right? So the center of a blood vessel, or the lumen of a blood vessel, is carrying blood, right? The lumen of a salivary gland tubule is carrying saliva in the center of that tube. So here's the center of some kidney tubule. You could say distal convoluted tubule, if you like, or proximal convoluted tubule. And then here is blood on the other side of these cells, nice, simple, cuboidal epithelium. And, of course, here's the apical surface. Here's the basal surface. And remember that the cells can have different components in the cell membrane on different sides of the cell. So the apical cell surface is going to look a lot different than the basal side. And it's the nucleus that determines where all of these different kinds of proteins go. So what do we have on this apical surface right here? I see a protein, right? And it's going to move sodium from high concentration to low inside the cell. Do you believe that? Where is sodium always at a high concentration? It's always high. So sodium is going to want to diffuse inside the cell, right? Here we have glucose, low concentration in the filtrate inside this kidney tubule. It's higher inside the cell. So what is necessary for glucose to enter the cell? Yeah, it needs energy. For sure, it needs energy. Now, do you see ATP here? So could that be primary active transport? Secondary active transport, right? So just key on ATP. So here is secondary active transport. Sodium and glucose are moving in the same direction, so we call that a symporter. If you want to call it co-transporter, that's okay. All right, so now we got sodium inside the cell, glucose inside the cell. Glucose is high inside the cell, low in the blood, so glucose will want to move from the cell into the blood. And will it want to go? High to low, easy, just by diffusion. But glucose can't get across the cell membrane, can it? Because it's polar. Cell membrane is nonpolar. How does it get across the cell membrane? It's got to have a little transporter, right? And we call that facilitated diffusion because it doesn't require any energy source, right? Again, it's the energy already in the concentration gradient of glucose, high to low. There's energy in that gradient, and that's what works this little thing right here. So that is facilitated diffusion. All right, but we should never have high sodium inside the cell because if it's high inside the cell, then even this transporter can't work. So how do we get rid of the sodium? We pump it out. Here's that sodium potassium ATP pump, right? And when you see this pump right here, what immediately can you tell me about it? Primary active transport, so that means sodium goes from a lower concentration to a higher concentration outside the cell, right? So maintaining a low concentration on the inside so that the symporter up over here still can work. All right, so this is a really cool exam figure. All right, so make sure you know what primary active transport is, where secondary active transport is, what kind of secondary active transport it is, and something about facilitated diffusion. Which way can facilitated diffusion work? High to low, low to high? Always high to low, because it's diffusion, right? Just diffusion. Okay, so that is a really nice illustration, kind of synthesizing a whole bunch of things that we looked at already. Okay, well, sometimes your cell needs things other than the little solutes that are in solution. It might need to import into the cell some big macromolecules that are, you could think of these things as maybe being precipitates, large molecules not in solution. And this is what we call bulk transport. So here I have a lot of these big particles on the outside of the cell. The cell microtubules start to pull on the cell membrane, right, because they're microtubules controlled by those centrosomes, control the shape of the cell, and it forms a little pocket on the surface of the cell. So these big particles diffuse into this pocket, right? The microtubules then close off one end of this little pocket, and it forms a vesicle, pinches away from the cell membrane, and that's easy to do because the membranes are basically the same, right? And now we have these big particles inside the cell. They're behind this membrane, but I think you should see that these things really are inside the cell. This would be an example of bringing things inside of the cell. We call that endocytosis. And endocytosis requires energy to do that. Right? So you could consider this a primary active transport mechanism, but even though I don't see any ATP here, moving these big organelles around inside your cell will require ATP. Typically, we don't talk about it in primary or secondary or passive transport, right? We just say endocytosis. Endocytosis has two forms. It has two forms. Things can be brought inside the cell if they're a solid particle, right? Like you eating a hamburger, right? We call that phagocytosis, right? Cytosis is a cellular process, and phago means eating, okay? When I'm eating that hamburger, I'm phagocytizing it. Okay, I'm just chomping it down. That's what this cell is doing here. It's just eating these large particles, cell eating. There's another form where the cell brings in just the solution of material that's in this area. We call that cell drinking. That's otherwise known as pinocytosis. Yeah, pinocytosis, pinocytosis. Okay. The internet is back up on campus, so we could Google that, I suppose, and find out for sure what it is. Pinocytosis. Okay, so phagocytosis and pinocytosis are both specific examples of endocytosis. Yeah, endocytosis. All right, well, the opposite process can happen, right? There can be things inside of a vesicle, and those things can be moved over to the cell membrane via those microtubules. These things will just fuse together because these membranes are pretty much exactly the same. And then whatever inside the vesicle ends up outside of the cell, right? And we call that process, that's exocytosis. Yeah, that's exocytosis. We could also call it secretion. Right? So that's how a cell secretes something. So let's just say that these things are proteins, or modified proteins. Where are these modified proteins made initially inside the cell? It's on a ribosome. That's the workbench for sure. But it's not any old kind of ribosome. What does it have to, where is this ribosome situated? On the rough endoplasmic reticulum, right? If it's rough ER, it ends up inside a vesicle, moves over to the Golgi body where it's modified somehow. Maybe a lipid is added to it, maybe a sugar, maybe it's chopped in half, something like that. And then the Golgi packages it in another vesicle, which moves to the cell membrane, and then it is exocytosed or secreted. We call that a secretory pathway. All right, so is bulk transport a form of passive or active transport? It's active transport. Yeah, so things can move against their concentration gradient. All right, here we see. Next time we're going to talk about membrane potential, and that membrane potential has to do with positive and negative charges. So what's another name for potential? Membrane potential is the same thing as membrane voltage. A difference in electrical charge across the membrane. Okay. Okay, sign and sheet is going around someplace. Bring it on down. Is anybody listening to these lectures online again? Yeah? Okay. I'll keep doing it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, they're WAV files on the internet. Make sure you copy that file from the internet and put it on your computer. Right click, and then copy, save as, something like that, save target as, save link as, put it into a 241 folder that you've made on your hard drive, and then you can open it with a media player. Okay. Sometimes Windows Media Player has a problem. There's a media player that has always worked for me no matter what, and it's called a VLC. VLC, and the link for getting it, it's a free plugin, is in Blackboard. The VLC Media Player. So once you get that file on your computer, you can drag and drop it, or you can right-click on that file and say Open With, and then choose VLC Player. And then it has never not worked. Yeah.